Hello in all this listening world, and welcome to this week's edition of Big Mouth, the Thinking Obsessives pop culture talk show, where we talk about what's really worth paying attention to in music, film, books and TV. I'm Andrew Harrison, and this week we're going to be talking about, amongst other things, the third album by Electronic Heat Millennials, The XX. Is it The XX or the Double X? The XX. The return of card-carrying cosmic weirdos, The Flaming Lips, and Visions, Dreams and Rumours, a splendid biography of Stevie Nicks by one of this week's special guests. She's a prolific rock biographer who has also told the stories of The Slits, Lee Brillo of Dr. Feelgood, Wilco Johnson and Jesus and Mary Chain. Her debut novel, Shine on Marquee Moon, is available now. She's a proper Essex girl, she plays the drums, and she's no stranger to Soho Radio. She often fills in for Gary Crowley's punk show when the Crow Man is tied up. Hello, Zoe Howe, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. How are you doing? Lovely to be here. Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm not bad, thank you. We're going to talk about your Stevie Nicks book in a minute, but in the world of the oeuvre of the rock biography, what are your own favourites?
Oh, just across the board. Yeah. I always tend to go back to Keith Richards' life. Mm-hmm. I think that's an absolute killer, and I just think he comes across just exactly as you want him to.
He's got a lot of good material to play with, hasn't he?
He has. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I've got a weakness for things like songs they never play on the radio, the story of Nico in Hair Declined, because right. Like, the material's great, but in a totally different way. You know, it's like you're not seeing anybody at their zenith. You're seeing like the kind of the pathos of what it's like when it's not working out.
Absolutely, yeah. Now that can be the most interesting kind of the most interesting stories can come out that way.
We all encounter writer's block now and again. Is there anything that you are there any rock biographies you go back to kind of re-stimulate yourself if you get stuck? You get stuck on something.
With biographies, I don't find the writer's block as hard as with fiction, because obviously when you're working with an artist or with an artist's story, you know, the material is coming from them, and you can always talk to someone else, or you can always refer to some, you know, some more research, which will sort of kickstart you. But the, I mean, I sometimes go back to the first ever rock memoir that I ever read, and I was far too young to read it. I was probably about 8, and I bought it at a market, and it was this battered old copy of Moon the Loon.
Oh my God!
Which was this incredible education for a little girl. You know, I've never quite recovered. I think it probably explains why I'm the damaged person I am today.
Did you think that Moon the Loon was like an amazing kid's story? Like, you know, Benji the Bear or something.
Well, I was obsessed with The Who at that age, because my dad had this crazy record collection. It has loads of sort of R&B and The Who and Stones. And I just was obsessed with The Who, and I loved Keith Moon. And I think he kind of, you know, got me into sort of wanting to play the drums. So,
I actually picked up Goodnight Moon, thinking it was a biography of how Keith Moon kind of like finished off every night. And I was sorely disappointed.
Well, also with us today is a returning Big Mouth regular and also a rock biography addict himself. He's an actual Doctor of Pop with an ology and everything. He writes about the music business for The Guardian and Q magazine, and he meets famous people for The Big Issue. He's a massive U2 fan. He was especially excited about them not only doing the Joshua Tree but also being supported by Mumford & Sons. It's Eamon Ford. Hello, Eamon. Have you got your U2 tickets yet?
I've got them all. I've bought all of the tickets. I'm going to pick them up on secondary sites.
Come on, you can't begrudge them a chance to give it another go, can you? You
know? They desperately need a payday as well, because they are on the bones of their hours.
Well, so. Now that the Celtic Tiger is just a rug on Bono's floor, they kind of need to get a few quid in there.
Well, exactly.
In the coffers,
fair play to them.
What's your own personal rock biography favourite, present company accepted?
I tend to read loads of stuff about the industry very boringly. So, yeah, I like lots of books about the industry.
What's the best boring book about the industry?
Goodness me. Frederick Dannon's Hitman is still the kind of the classic, because that was all about the kind of Paola scandal in the 70s that nearly kind of killed Clive Davis's career and so forth. And that's kind of the benchmark. Although, kind of more recent books, Appetite for Self-Destruction was really good, about kind of the impact of Napster and kind of the shock effects from that. So I read lots and lots and lots of books about that.
Excellent. Also, you heard his voice then momentarily, ensuring that there's absolutely no slacking or goofing off in the studio at all. It's the Berry Gordy of podcasts, our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt Hall. How are you?
I'm very well, Andrew Harrison.
What's on your hip-hop bookshelf?
Quite a lot of old books, not very many current ones. But I made a note of my two favourite rock biographies, both of which came out a long time ago, and both of which I think are still available, one of which is real and one of which it isn't. The real one is The Life and Times of Little Richard by Charles White, which is just incredible.
That's an eye-opener.
And I read that at quite an impressionable age as well, yeah. lots of stories about throwing diamond rings off the Golden Gate Bridge, off the Sydney Harbour Bridge, when seeing Sputnik go over because he thought it was the end of days.
Wow.
And leaving special presents for his auntie in a cardboard box,
and lots of struggling with his extracurricular lifestyle choices as well.
But the other one, I just need to mention it because I don't know how many people have read it, but it's one called Elvis the Novel, and it's by Robert Graham and Keith Batty, and it's the Elvis story as it should have been, and it's drop dead hilarious.
Wow.
Okay, that's fantastic. Good. Right, well, before we get into the books and the music, we're going to do a quick news story. Eamon sort of touched on it a minute ago. The BBC's Victoria Derbyshire programme has found that Robbie Williams' management company had been putting tickets for his new tour direct onto secondary ticketing sites. These are the sites which supposedly enable people to get rid of the tickets that they bought by mistake, hem-hem, or discovered that they can't go to, hem-hem. Well, they actually widely believed to be just massive outlets for digital touting, really. IE Music, Robbie's management, put so-called platinum tickets straight onto Get Me In and Seatwave at a markup of over 50%. And it is ironic, given that in 2015, IE signed a petition against secondary ticketing. Eamon, what's going on?
What is going on? That's a very, very good question. And obviously, we have to tread very, very, very carefully legally here. Secondary ticketing is a huge, huge thing for the industry as both a pain and a revenue source, a kind of secondary revenue source. There's kind of four main resale platforms, two of which are run by, are owned by Ticketmaster, which is the biggest ticketing company in the world, which is the division of Live Nation, which is the biggest promoter in the world. So they've kind of got, they basically own live music. So kind of part of that was a response to the fact of online ticketing and people realised that they could sell on these tickets. The government has taken a very hands-off approach. They initially said, let's self-regulate it, although in the sports industry, they've been very, very aggressive about kind of stemming that. Although I know in regards to football, there was lots of issues around violence and having to keep certain people out of certain games. The music industry is still kind of pushing for lobbying for the government to intervene. The government had kind of taken it, oh, it's a free enterprise, it's entrepreneurship approach. And it turns out that the artists themselves are part of this new drive to be entrepreneurs because, one, nobody will name names. It's the music industry's huge dirty secret that a lot of these artists are in on a lot of these backdoor deals.
So if you can get 160 quid for a ticket that's marked as 95 quid, doesn't that mean that the actual market price of that ticket is 160 quid? If people are willing to pay that, what is the problem?
David Hepworth made quite a good point on his blog yesterday saying that, for whatever reason, artists may not want to be seen to be pricing their tickets at 160 quid. It may be quite, not the right message to send out to your fans.
I was at a live industry conference a couple of years ago and Michael Rapino, who is the head of Live Nation, who's possibly the most powerful person in the music industry, and he was asked about that and he said that we really need to, and I quote, price the house better. He said if people are prepared to pay four times the price for the front row seats, we should be able to put them on the market. But he kind of blame shifted quite a lot by saying, well, the artists don't want to do that because it makes them seem a bit greedy. But as it turns out, we find out that they are being greedy, but through kind of nefarious means.
But if you price up the front of the house and effectively the front row of every single show is just a bunch of bankers on entertainment nights, that's going to actually kill the entertainment of the show.
See, this is what they're concerned about, which is a lot of managers and a lot of agents are saying that this is going to kill repeat business because if you're blocking out the fans who supported these acts all the way through. I spoke to the promoter for Muse last year about this, and he said that in Europe they're putting contracts in saying that if tickets from the ticket company and the agent are put up on secondary sites, they can legally pull the show. So they're taking an aggressive stance against this because they don't want to be seen as kind of involved or dirty by association.
But also the kind of like the 9 a.m. ticket sale where you sort of sit there on Friday morning frantically tapping refresh with four browsers open has kind of turned everybody into a tout, isn't it? Because if you get through, you might as well buy four and try and flog a couple.
Well,
and suddenly I don't think anybody's hands are entirely clean on this.
But also related to that is kind of tightening on an industrial scale, which is through bots, which there have been moves in New York to outlaw that. That's one of the things that the Fanfare Alliance, which is a kind of collective of artists and managers who are addressing this whole thing, that's one of the things that they want to address as well, that this kind of this tightening at scale is happening. Although some managers are being very outspoken and saying, we know there's this secondary economy and we don't want to be involved with it. I interviewed Adam Tudhope, who's the manager of Mumford & Sons, who's a very, very smart manager and a very, very moral manager as well. And he estimated that last year on a short US tour that they, quote unquote, lost $3 million to secondary sales. Mm. So I said, is there an argument that this is the Napster moment for the live music industry? And if so, should you be working with these people? Yeah. And he said, no, that's dirty money. We do not want to be seen to be taking money, which is effectively screwing fans.
Yeah. But surely it's just it needs the industry to kind of reset its mindset, if you like, because when you go to the theatre, nobody objects to paying more for the better seats with the better view.
Yeah, but you go to the theatre and there isn't a mosh pit. You go to the theatre and
there isn't a mosh pit at most stadiums and stuff.
No, but a lot of gigs, there's an atmosphere of crowded excitement and urgency and people spilling beer all over the place. It's a different experience. You know, theatre is definitely a full-on middle-class experience, isn't it? And we don't want our rock shows to turn into basically the Royal Opera House, although the Pet Shop Boys, the Royal Opera House, was obviously absolutely fabulous. But we don't want everything to be like that.
You have tiered pricing at gigs anyway. So you've got the choice to go stand in or seat it. And then within that, you pay by the block. So if you're buying for the O2 or Wembley or one of the, because this is really where, this is really what Titan's about. Nobody's got to make a profit off selling tickets for the Lexington or the Dublin Castle shows or anything like that. So it's, but at those big venues, they already have tier prices. Maybe a choice of like three tiers, but that's it. It exists. So people are used to that idea of price flexibility.
Well, as ever, Half Man, Half Biscuit have the solution. Sponsoring the mosh pits is what it's all about. For God's sake, let's have some actual music to listen to then. Let's move on for a minute. Every week, we actually ask our guests to come in with a tune that they love, an editor's recommendation, a track that they can't get out of their head right now. Eamon Ford, what have you got for us?
I came to this very late, and I know very, very little about this band, and it's their third album. And it was only because a friend was recommended as a kind of end of year pick. So I haven't even dug into the previous two albums because I love this album so much that it might ruin it if I discover they weren't quite as good for the first two albums. It's a band called Ulysses, who have been described as psych glam. They're a UK band. That's all I know about them because I kind of quite like the mystery. And possibly my favourite song on the album is a song called Crazy Horses Ride the Snake, which is a great, great title. And basically, as my friend who recommended it said, they basically sound like all of 70s rock kind of in one beautiful package. I played this, I was on holidays over Christmas, and I put this on my smartphone of choice.
Smartphones are available.
Yes, and I spent Christmas Day walking around Marrakesh just listening to this over and over again, which was quite the thing.
Okay, listeners, well, you can recreate Eamon's Joe Alton moment by listening to Crazy Horses Ride the Snake by Ulysses. There we go, not the Osmonds. That was Crazy Horses Ride the Snake by Ulysses, as chosen by Eamon Ford. Now, in sharp contrast, as you know, we have with us the prolific rock and roll biographer Zoe Howe. She's written the lives of Lee Brillo, The Jesus and Mary Chain and The Slits. And her Stevie Nicks biography, Visions, Dreams and Rumours, is coming out soon in paperback. Was this a dispassionate choice? Have you always been a hopeless fan of the Nicks?
Well, I've always loved Fleetwood Mac and Nicks in particular. She just seems like the perfect kind of eccentric rock and roll icon, you know. And I always loved sort of the many facets of Stevie Nicks. You know, she's this amazing kind of, obviously, a sex symbol, very charismatic, but also she's an incredible songwriter. You know, a lot of Fleetwood Mac's biggest hits were written by her. And also she's this kind of mystical being as well. And she lives in a kind of bubble and she's very kind of, you know, there's a lot of mystery there. And and so I kind of wanted to, I didn't want to kind of like ruin the mystery, but I wanted to sort of like put over a kind of celebration, I suppose.
She's kind of the American Kate Bush in a way.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, that's a very good point.
Before we get into it, let's have a listen. From Rumours, this is Goldust Woman. Stevie Nicks books about kleptomania. That was Fleetwood Mac with Goldust Woman, and Zoe Howe is here with her top hat on and her diaphanous bits of doily and all.
For knocking all that equipment over, but I just get taken with the mood and then it's all over. Absolutely. I'm afraid. Just have to start whirling.
We don't have a straw and a big pile of cocaine. So Zoe, I've got to confess, I've never been converted to the Mac and Stevie Nicks. What am I missing? Tell me what I'm missing.
Well, I mean, there are so many sort of Fleetwood Macs within Fleetwood Mac. Obviously, you know, you've got the Peter Green Fleetwood Mac, which I was sort of weaned on as a kid. Absolutely loved Peter Green. And so the Fleetwood Mac with Buckingham and Nicks, Lindsay Buckingham, Stevie Nicks, But, you know, and so they added this kind of completely new dimension. And Fleetwood Mac have always had a kind of rolling lineup over the years, and they're quite open to sort of new influences coming in and out, which I think is really, really progressive and makes for some great, great music. But I suppose the thing with Nicks and Buckingham is that one of the injections they one of the things they brought to the Mac, which is already quite a troubled band anyway, was sort of more kind of romantic angst. Mm. And so within the Mac, you have these, you know, these many kind of interlocking relationships which are breaking down and building up, and they you know, they keep going throughout the whole thing, and they never get closure. So you go and see the Mac live, and there's all these kind of very meaningful glances, and it's all very theatrical, but it's real as well.
This is what I found so fascinating. The book, the fact that, you know, because, you know, I was aware that this is the big rock and roll soap opera.
Absolutely.
This is the Dallas, Peyton Place and crossroads of rock and roll.
It's kind of more South American magic realism, though.
Actually, yeah, it's like a telenovela in the form of a rock band.
Yeah.
But I
thought of Mick Fleetwood in a beanie cap and a Birmingham accent in Crossroads. Mending the wiring.
But I had no idea exactly how intricate it was. And literally, absolutely everybody is hopping on with everybody else, and everybody else is roadie, and everybody else's personal
members assistants. Of the crew are getting involved, and it's like this ultimate kind of sexual psychodrama. It's amazing.
Did you have to have a diagram to work out? Because it would have a lot of lines on it, wouldn't it?
Indeed, yeah. But out of all the pain and the kind of broken romances come these amazing songs, and I think Stevie Nicks' songs were always my favourites, and Lindsey Buckingham's. There's so much tension, you know, much tension in those songs.
He does come across as a terrible git in the book. Did you find yourself drawn towards Team Stevie?
Absolutely, I did. Yeah, completely. Although Lindsey Buckingham is a genius, and I love his solo work as well. I think he's an amazing songwriter. And there's a lot of pain there that's being channeled, and you can hear the pain in this voice. And it, you know, to quote The Odd Couple, even his hair looks tense. You know, everything is electric and tense, and you know, amazing. And Stevie, on the hand, is this very soft, kind of mellifluous character who's very emotional, and you know, you can see how the two kind of rubbed each other up the wrong way.
Did you interview her for the book?
Sadly not. Mm. She, I did try many different avenues to sort of get hold of Stevie Nicks, and you know, obviously she didn't know me from Adam. You know, why should she speak to this sort of stranger who goes, I want to write about your life, you know, how presumptuous. But so they, you know, I never kind of got word that she was up for collaborating, but I also never got told, you're not allowed to do this. So I just thought, okay, I'll just do this, you know, with the best will in the world. You know, she has created, I mean, one of the things I found interesting about her and writing about her was that she's created a bubble within which she lives, and it's like a sort of created family, and she sort of draws the people she likes around her, and it's very protected. And I sort of get that. I understand why she feels she has to do that. But as you say, I think you're absolutely right. Sometimes with some books and some biographies, when they're unauthorised, you actually get to tell a more balanced story because you're not under the thumb of the artist who's sort of breathing down your neck.
Yeah. As a fan and aficionado, did you discover surprises? You know the story pretty much inside out. Did you just discover further stuff as you were delving in?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I suppose, you know, with the Mac, everything's kind of slightly inside out, and especially with Stevie Nicks, you know, all of the scandals and the sort of awful stories and kind of outrageous things, we all kind of know them. So actually, it was the sort of more intimate, sort of reflective sides of her that you know, I was enjoying getting to know whilst working on the book.
Yeah,
I suppose.
What was really interesting to me, I mean, obviously, as I say, I'm, as you can probably tell, almost entirely ignorant of the Fleetwood Mac ever, but I thought it was very interesting the way you actually go into what it's like to write a song, which so many rock biographies and actual rock journalism doesn't seem to display any interest in, and you go and tell the stories of individual songs and where they come from and why she wrote that way and what brought it out, you know, and which is, in the context of a book, really fascinating. It's the kind of thing that when you're editing a feature for a magazine and somebody delivers you a copy with a great big bit in the middle about how this song was written, you go, get rid of that. Where's the drugs and the tellies going out the window? Hurry up, you know, pick up the pace a little bit. But actually, I find it rather fascinating.
Well, the thing with Stevie Nicks, I suppose, and I'm glad you picked up on that, is that she is absolutely defined by her songs. Her songs are like her children. And I, you know, obviously, we don't have, you know, Stevie's own voice in the book, but I say, you know, if you want to read Stevie's autobiography, just listen to her songs and read the lyrics, because it's all there. They're like diary entries.
I think that the songwriting thing's really interesting, because when her and Lindsey Buckingham joined the group, they were this kind of self-contained unit already, and then suddenly that changed the whole dynamic of kind of how songs were written. So you had this kind of duo suddenly were put into this group context. So there's like lots of really interesting things, because generally bands are formed around a kind of a core of songwriters, be it kind of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards or Lennon and McCartney, and that defines the dynamic of the group. And sometimes they let George Harrison write a song, but suddenly you had these two people were parachuted in, and then they became the biggest band in the world, which is incredible. And that The kind of artistic dynamic of the band completely changed because it absorbed this existing.
If you're going to
respect,
if you're
but not successful,
say something about
duo.
Kenny Dalglish here.
No, I'm not going to say it's like Kenny Dalglish. Yeah. It's like when the Human League got the girls in. It changed everything.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. It did.
So Zoe, if I'm going to put myself on an intensive course of the Mac, and I'm going to start mainlining Mac, what should I do in order to get on board with this? Apart from reading your amazing book.
Well, I mean, naturally that is top of the list, but I mean, obviously listen to all the albums. You know, listen to Rumours in particular, and Tusk, which I think is quite underrated. I think people didn't know
Tusk.
What to do with Tusk at the time. But yeah, I love Tusk as well.
It was a great example of a band being given creative control at the absolute height of their fame and their massive drug consumption. Mm. And it's this bizarre kind of curate's egg of an album. And
completely.
I really like it because it's basically a band just going, do you know what? Let's just do whatever the hell we want.
And well, it was very much under Lindsay's cosh. I mean, he really took control, and he was starting to listen to a lot of punk and new wave, and he really wanted to push the Mac out of AOR and into this new direction. And the others were a bit more reticent. So you actually, as a result, hear these quite disparate songwriting voices on Tusk, whereas in the past they're more, you know, they're a bit more coherent. Whereas on Tusk, you know, a Stevie song is very Stevie, and a Lindsay song is jagged, and he's sort of trying to kind of transmute some of those influences. So of course it's not punky at all, but it's, you know, he's kind of
Tusk. The track itself, I remember really, really loving that one as a kid actually, and thinking, I don't know whether it came out before Adam and the Ants, but that kind of you know,
well, had that, it was that LA marching band, wasn't it?
That's right.
But I guess if you go and see them live, I've seen them live a couple of times in the last few years at the O2, and they were amazing. But basically, they play most of Rumours, they play a good chunk of Tusk and a good whack of Tango in the Night, and then a couple of other tracks, and that's about it, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
So you kind of, it's those three albums.
Absolutely. Okay, let's have a change of pace with some different music. Zoe, it's your turn. What's your editor's recommendation that you've brought in? What tune is...
Right, the tune I have brought in is Donny Hathaway's cover version of Jealous Guy. And I just think it's just a song I'm listening to a lot at the moment. It's just, I just can't get enough of it. It's a really soulful, expressive, sexy interpretation of this great song. And I just love his voice. But I also really love it. It's got this kind of really incongruous sort of honky-tonk barroom piano on it, which just works so well. So, yeah, I'm
Let's
loving that at
then.
The moment.
Donny Hathaway and Jealous Guy. Donny Hathaway's live version of Jealous Guy, as chosen by our special guest, Zoe Howe. Okay, right, it might be January, but there are actually albums coming out. Traditionally, it's a time of year for The Outsiders and The Long Shots, but this week there are a couple of quite strong contenders. The Flaming Lips abandon the abrasive drone and metallic horror of their last couple of albums and get back to warm cosmic electronica with their 12th or 14th or something or other album, which is entitled, and I hope I'm going to say this right, Oschi Mlody, which is Polish, and it means Eyes of the Young. If we have any Polish listeners who want to be angry about my mispronunciation, give us a shout. But first, before we talk about Flaming Lips, we're going to talk about the third album by The XX, the agonisingly sensitive, super minimal electronic trio. From that album, I See You, here's one of the lead tracks. This one's called On Hold.
I don't blame you. We got carried away. I can't hold on.
Thought I had you on hold. I thought I had you on hold.
On Hold by the XX. Did you spot the I Can't Go For That sample? Zoe Howe. The XX have a knack for taking the kind of clubbiness out of clubbing music and making a rave sound like the loneliest place in the world. What did you make of it?
Well, I don't think it's really aimed at me, but you know, I'm not massively familiar with the XX, but I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was quite pleasant. Personally, I prefer a bit more blood and guts in my music.
Yes.
I like a bit of a warp in the weft. I want some creepiness. Mm. But I have a feeling this album would grow on me. I like that there are some lovely vocal harmonies.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's not massively for me.
This, to me, it's like part of the emotional landscape of pop now is very buttoned up and very introspective. It's not about letting things. It's not about spilling your guts.
Mm.
It's about sort of looking into your inward fragility kind of thing. And I think they do it very well.
They do. Yeah. And as I say, I'm sure, you know, I'm sort of enjoying kind of getting to know it a little bit. But as you say, sterility is a good word. I tend to be sort of drawn naturally more to sort of a bit of dirt.
Yes. Active sensuality. Eamon, what did you make of this album?
When I was given my homework to listen to this album, I listened to it for the first time. I kind of went, I really don't get this at all. And I kind of played it a couple of times and it just wasn't connecting. And then when you said, what do you think of the album? I went, I don't really like it. And then I went back and gave it another listen, and about three or four tracks really clicked.
Yeah.
And I really liked them. But I find, and I get the irony of what I'm just about to say, given the way that I speak, but they need elocution lessons, because it's just this wishy-washy, lispy, lazy delivery. And that kind of makes all the songs sound the same. There's lots of really interesting stuff production-wise that Jimmy XX is doing, and I think just when those two start singing, they make everything kind of just this kind of very grey. Maybe that's the point. I think the most interesting thing I think about this album was that I heard this story. I don't know if it's true or not, but it was supposed to come out on the 20th of January, and then they realised that was going to clash with Trump's inauguration, so it would get buried in the kind of the media stuff. So they brought the release forward. I don't know if that's true or not.
I'm not sure that the Venn diagram of people who are interested in Donald Trump's inauguration and people who are interested in the fact that
on the 20th of January, it's just going to be a complete media saturation about Trump.
Well, it's really good that they found some really clear water where nobody's banging on about Donald Trump at the moment, isn't it? You know, they've got the quiet before the storm.
I like the use of clear water there.
I'd just like to say with this, I think when they first came out, there was a feeling that when Jamie XX went off and did his kind of more clubby stuff, it was, the feeling that I had was like, well, that's because he can't do it within the environment of the band, because they were really minimal and very breathy, and he was the guy who wanted to kind of put the bangers on, the afterburners on, as it were. It feels like they're starting to kind of combine those two things, the breathiness and the minimalism, but it seems to be slightly more up tempo and a slightly kind of fuller sound. And that to me kind of a little bit is reducing, I mean, obviously you've got to move on and develop, but it's kind of reducing a little bit what made them special and different in the first place.
The songwriting, actually, you would never have particularly thought of them as a capital S songwriting band in the past. It was all about sonic cathedrals of sound and tableaus and textures and all the rest of it. What struck me about this is that you could see a couple of these tunes adapted for an X Factor finale in the future. You know, you've got there's a song called Performance, which is all about creating the world, putting on this brave show. There's a fantastic song called Brave For You, which the arrangement really, if you filled out the arrangements and added the strings and the grand band, I could totally see Simon Cowell pushing this on someone, because it is about the concern of now, which is I'm weak and I'm fragile and I'm being brave in front of a large audience. I think there's actually a lot better songwriting going on here than maybe you might think of a band like this.
Yeah.
Maybe is it a bit like Bob Dylan then, in that they need other people to sing the songs for them to show you what they could sound like?
I think the songs work perfectly for their voices. I think that as the two, the tension between the male and the female voice, I think this is a really, really nice album. It's not kind of something you put on before you're going out, but it's got some great songs in it.
Surprised by how much I liked it, and I think I probably will go back and do more.
In the old days of Mixmag, this was referred to as like a 4 a.m. come down record. Well, everybody's come back from the club and for some reason they can't get to sleep.
They're quite excited, all those lights.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's put on something a little bit emotional.
Ice
creams.
And they're really, the samples are used really cleverly. They're kind of, they're not just kind of doing it all by numbers. That track Replica
I like that one.
And every breath you take sample on it, which is lovely, worked in beautifully.
They're a very literate band, and I think he's a really interesting producer as well.
I think I agree with Zoe, though. I think I just want a bit more kind of, euphoria in my music, a bit more kind of like sense of human. Human excitement in there. Should we talk about some old guys? Let's talk about the Flaming Lips, who seemed to lose their way sort of in the mid-noughties, when we sort of started to get a lot of unfocused and frankly terrifying art rock around the Embryonic album afterwards. And then they started doing lots of collaborations with people like Keisha and Tame Impala and Neon Indian, and it was like they were running through Pitchfork with a highlighter pen. This one, Oshi Melody, I think it's a lot better. It's got a lot more light and shade and an actual pathos in there. Zoe, what did you make of it?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite a departure. I mean, I was never massively into the Flaming Lips. I was never a huge fan of
of Wayne Coyne's voice. I thought it was sort of sounded a little bit kind of a little bit anemic for my taste.
Yeah.
But you know, I really enjoyed it, and it wasn't what I expected at all. Mm. I sort of detected these sort of soupçons of 80s synths, and it kind of made me think I can imagine quite a few of the tracks on this album being used maybe in a sort of in Stranger Things, or you know, being used in film and TV, because they're really atmospheric.
Loads of analog synths and stuff like that. Yeah. Wayne's voice is always a sticking point with a lot of people. I love it because he can't sing. I don't really like people who can sing.
No, fair enough.
I don't want to hear people's amazing techniques. I want to hear somebody straining to say something with a kind of imperfect instrument. And I think it does give it great pathos. Eamon, what did you reckon of?
Oh, we're talking about one gear. I find it quite a lot. I find myself kind of nodding off. It was almost like when you're driving really, really late at night on a quiet road, and you're kind of you feel yourself zone out, and then you lurch back and you go, I can't remember the last kind of 3 minutes of driving, and I find myself doing that, kind of going, is that still on? And I really, really tried with it, but I just find myself. I know it's the most overused word in the social media age. I didn't find it very engaging. It didn't hook me in any way. I think it's a nice thing to kind of have on in the background, and it's probably the kind of thing that I would have on the background when I'm doing something else, but I didn't. I wasn't what they refer to as lean forward in my listening.
See, this is, Eamon, this is, you've just become a victim of the short attention
span. I have. Yeah.
Modern culture.
I am.
I like that fact that you can drift off into it. I think it's genuinely, their music is genuinely psychedelic. And it is, you know, there's a fantastic track called There Should Be Unicorns, which it starts off on this mad electronic reverie. And then suddenly this kind of James Earl Jones voice appears.
It is
James Earl Jones,
no,
isn't it?
I think it's somebody else.
It's doing a very good impression.
Yeah, describing effectively what sounds like this kind of restaurant at the end of the universe, ultimate mega rave. Yeah. Where
that was quite funny, that bit.
Spectacular, insane creatures, and if the police turn up, we'll just give them so much money, they'll give up their jobs. And to me, that's like the core of what the Flaming Lips are about. It's like if you got hold of the Grateful Dead and you took out all the 18-minute guitar solos and you made them learn ancient synthesizers. Stephen Droege, I think, is massively underrated as a producer in the Flaming Lips. He's one of the members. They're all kind of co-producers. For creating these insane landscapes and sort of, you know, being that kind of architect of modern psychedelia, really.
But I saw them a few years ago headline the other stage at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And they made complete sense. There was Wayne Coyne in a massive kind of see-through ball in the crowd, and everybody on stage, and it was brilliant. I didn't really get the feeling with this that there were any tracks that would translate to that. Mm. Well, big,
yeah, like
massive.
Do you realise, or is
there was nothing that you could imagine 30,000 people blissfully chanting along to with their arms in the air.
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they did their big pop moment with the soft bulletin with Waiting for Superman and Yoshimi versus the Pink Robots, which has got the great Do You Realise, one of the great classic singles of all time. And they've done their big pop moment. But also, I think basically Wayne's been through the mill. He's been through like a personal miserable time. You know, he split up with his wife of God knows how long. And I don't think, you know, at his best, he was always like this kind of, Pied Piper, merry prankster, turn up the sunshine, microdots for everybody. This is going to be amazing. I think Roy Wilkinson, music writer and friend of the podcast, said if they ever have an American Doctor Who, it ought to be Wayne Coyne. You know,
cause, he's right.
Crazy hair, ridiculously positive. And he's been through the mill in the past few years, and I think that's why he's become introspective. Also, the other thing, you know, okay, it's like the stupid conceit of the time to think that everything a bit sad is all about Donald Trump. But, you know, when you're the Flaming Lips and you represent the vanguard of furry freakdom and everything you love is just basically being destroyed before your very eyes. Mm. There's a track on there called The Castle, which I think is about the suicide of one of their friends, but it's about the ruin of everything beautiful. It's about everything coming down around your ears. And to me, like, that's as important in pop music as, come on, everybody, let's go mental.
Completely,
you know,
you've
got to have something to get you through the miserable times. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I like the fact that it's got that kind of ambient quality of changing your environment. Have you ever been to see them, Zoe?
I haven't, no, but I gather a Flaming Lips show is a thing to behold, to put it mildly.
It's quite joyous.
It sounds amazing.
Because he kind of comes in this bowl and kind of rolls through the crowd, and then there's like people dressed up as animals, and he's got this kind of confetti cannon that he runs around and shoots into the crowd and stuff, and it's just this wonderful...
There's just random people wandering around on stage.
And then they do this really quite brilliant cover version of Bohemian Rhapsody as well. It was a kind of a live staple for a long time.
I imagine that.
So the Flaming Lips, we think they're a good thing, don't we? We do.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, yeah.
Let's have a track from that Flaming Lips album. This is Sunrise, Eyes of the Young.
The sunrise insists on gladness, but how can I be glad?
That was the Flaming Lips from Ochi Melodi with Sunrise, open brackets, Eyes of the Young, close brackets. So, we're coming to the end of the show, and it's time for closing time chatter, when our guests offload whatever is getting their goat this week. Eamon, what have you got?
I've got it in front of me, although it's got a slightly different title from the preview copy I was given. I believe it's called, we hope you have enjoyed the show.
It's a book, by the way.
Yeah, it is a book, by the way. Yes. The History of Rock and Pop on British TV by Jaff Evans, which is, I believe, in the middle of February, which is wonderful, and it goes into the full story of the obvious things that you know, like Top of the Pops and Ready Steady Go and the Old Grey Whistle Test and the Tube and so forth. But lots of kind of dry runs for all of these shows, particularly in the 60s. There was a lot of attempts to get pop shows off the ground and a lot of competition between the BBC and ITV to get shows off the ground. And it's really interesting how the kind of he traces the evolution of that through the arrival of Channel 4 and how that they approach music. And then the move into kind of multi-channel broadcasting and then into online. So it's a really interesting history of these very steered characters who suddenly realised that pop music was the way to go on TV, and they kind of they backed the farm on it. And it was a really small world that they were all existing in. They all kind of fell out with each other and went off and set up rival shows and so forth. So it does it decade by decade, and it's a really fascinating history of music on British TV.
Are there mad revelations? Do we discover
not really. Although he does write in a little caveat at the start. He's kind of going like, obviously post U-Tree, there's been a kind of whitewashing of this. Of the role of certain individuals, Jimmy Savile. So he said, like, he talks about Jimmy Savile's role within that. So maybe we're in these post-U-Tree times where this stuff isn't going to be in kind of Stalinistically written out of history. You go, Jimmy Savile was clearly a dreadful person, but he was involved in all of these things, and you can't ignore it. Yeah. And they talk about Jonathan King as well. So these people, while obviously was clearly music on TV, was clearly a hotbed for very, very, very bad activity. He doesn't kind of shy away from talking about these people and going, yeah, they're abhorrent, but they were important to the evolution of these shows.
Mm-hmm. Zoe Howe, what's your closing time chatter? What have you got?
Well, I recently went to a 12th night celebration, because we have just had 12th night, of course. Wanting to see these guys for years, at last I went to see them, and they're called The Lion's Part, and they're like this kind of mad, kind of very traditional theatre company, very wild, very kind of. Every year they do a 12th night celebration on Bankside, just outside the Globe, open air, and then they kind of do a procession through that sort of area of South Southwark, and then they end up at the George Inn, which is London's oldest galleried inn or oldest pub or something, and then they sing songs, and it's all wassailing basically. It's a great big wassailing festival.
So you went and got your wassail on.
I did.
A lot of woodwind instruments.
Oh yes, lots of like yes, yes.
Any
reeds
crumb horns
and some.
To be heard.
I think there was definitely a crumb horn.
Amazing.
Or two, and no, it was fabulous. They're talking about sort of Christmas traditions, but also you know the idea of it being about the supposed death of the sun, because it's getting darker and darker, and then after the solstice, the sun is born, or you know the son of God is born. So you can sort of see the way that Christianity kind of bastardized all these pagan traditions, and it's just massively entertaining.
Did you find your pagan earth energies were renewed?
Completely. Absolutely.
Post solstice.
It was fabulous. And they've got an incredible guy dressed up as the Green Man to sort of bring in the green. It's a sort of tradition. It's all kind of symbolic of basically blessing the harvest to come and sort of wishing health on people and making merry in
Amazing.
The darkest days of the year.
Talking of which, I've never read it before. It's The Lottery, Shirley Jackson's short story, which is about that kind of pagan tradition as well. So yeah. If you've not read that, read that. It's terrifying.
There we go.
Right.
Yeah, it's very. It's only about 20 minutes to read it, but it's a wonderfully dark short story about kind of paganism
Fantastic.
In the modern age.
That sounds good.
There we go. Wassail, wassail. Hear the mama get wicked. What have you got, Matt Hall?
I'd like to talk about Troll Hunters, which is a thing on Netflix, which is a cartoon series which has been put together by Guillermo del Toro, who did Pan's Labyrinth and whatever, but it's a cartoon series for kids. It's about a young boy who finds his way into a world full of kind of underneath the his city in California. It's a brilliant thing. It's amazing, actually. It's great. It stars stars people like Ron Perlman and Kelsey Grammer, and rather sadly, the main character, Jim, is voiced by Anton Yelchin, who played Chekhov in the Star Trek, and who sadly has kind of passed. But it's basically Del Toro said that he wanted to kind of recreate the kind of animated series he watched when he was a kid, of kind of like Johnny Quest and Speed Racer and stuff. And it's the animation's by DreamWorks. It's a collaboration with DreamWorks, so the animation is really fantastic.
So it's basically Pan's Labyrinth meets Marine Boy.
Essentially, yeah. Wow. It's
when you said
really
Troll Hunter,
good.
I thought it was going to be something to do with, like, you know, getting horrible internet people and confronting them on the driveway, yeah, which would be a good show.
Which would be a good show, but no.
It's things living under bridges. It's monsters.
Yeah, proper trolls, and all made of stone. And Kelsey Grammer's character is very funny, and there's some great writing with it. And it goes on for kind of like 25 parts, and I'm kind of watching it with my son, and it's absolute genius.
Amazing. It's only rocking trolls, and we like it. I'm going to stop. Sorry.
Somebody pass me the gun.
Well, mine, my closing time chatter is the Like Punk Never Happened Smash Hits Archive by Brian McCluskey, which has resurfaced in the past couple of days. He's just a member of the general public. He's been, since 2008, he's been scanning every single issue of Smash Hits and putting it online and making it available. It popped up again because it was credited on Top of the Pops Story of 1983. You know, all the information that, you know, from these fantastic magazines that was fed into that, that, you know, really good documentary over the Christmas and New Year period. And it just made me think, you know, seeing here's like literally millions of words of Smash Hits that have just been kind of lost like tears in the rain. Mm. This is how it's going to be preserved by people who love it. You know, the old magazines, I mean, somebody brilliantly did an archive of Select, which is only like 100 issues or so kind of thing, but it's like all the stuff that like me and Matt and all the people did in the 90s, you can actually now find it. And the thing that surprises me is that big publishing companies spend a huge amount of time and effort and money and aggression and kind of nastiness in making people sign away their rights to this past material, and then don't do a single thing with it. It just languishes on a hard drive somewhere. Mm. You know, it's never used. And the way it's going to get used is if people like Brian McCluskey just scan it, stick it on the internet, and who cares if it's legal or not, because it belongs to us. It's our culture and our heritage.
I think it's really interesting. Toyed around a friend of the podcast, Sylvia Patterson's amazing book from last year, and she was obviously, along with Tom Hayward, was the architect of that Smash Hits language. Yeah. And it's really interesting speaking to a lot of kind of younger journalists about this, because they obviously didn't grow up with Smash Hits in the same way that we did, and they're kind of almost jonesing for this style of writing. So it's this almost, I guess it's like kind of music magazine reissues or music magazine bootlegs in a way, where suddenly they go, here's the stuff that existed before you were born that was really interesting. Not to say that let's just all live in the past, but here are the reference points.
Yeah. But I think that's right for two reasons. One is everybody forgets that in Smash Hits there was absolutely brilliant copper bottom journalism. Mm. All the proper questions were asked. Nobody, you know, this was not in any way like, you know, half done or patronising. It was really, really good journalism. Yeah. Beautifully written, clever, funny, entertaining. But also, if you imagine reading that in contrast to the latest 5,000-word review of an inconsequential indie album on certain websites we could name, the latest joyless, reverential kind of, you know, faux intellectual attempt to breathe some kind of stature and grandeur into just another record. Compare that to a brilliant 200-word album review by Ian Craner or whatever.
I think lots of those magazines have made their, like, Smash Hits, by its very admission, and the people who wrote this said that music is simultaneously the greatest thing and the most ridiculous thing. Yeah. And they were able to straddle those two worlds. And a lot of music journalism now is very, very serious.
Yes.
Well, it's suffering under the misapprehension that music is capital I important. This is important. I mean, so we mustn't joke about it. We must take it terribly seriously. And of course, Smash Hits took music seriously enough to joke about it.
Absolutely.
Well, it's like all great kind of satire. You have to love the thing that you're satirizing to get the point. So they were kind of satirizing and praising these pop stars simultaneously, because They are ridiculous and they are wonderful in equal measure.
It must be dead exciting, mustn't it, to be like 19 and wanting to be a writer and finding an old Smash Hit. It must be like, for us, like finding an old rock and roll 7-inch from 1955 or an old reggae, you know, an old reggae dub plate from a completely different world, and going, you can do things differently.
Yeah. I was obsessed with Smash Hits growing up, because my sister, who I have an older sister, and she used to collect them, and I used to read them after her, and I was obsessed, and I just thought they were so great for that very reason. Completely irreverent. loving these pop stars, but also being able to completely poke fun at them, and I think that's massively healthy. It's
but
too
also,
much, people are too
like,
awestruck, I yes, think. Yes,
in Sylvia's book, she also, like, she plots that org of music journalism and the music press against that. She said that the artists were absolutely complicit in that. They wanted to be in smash hits so that people would make fun of them and come up with a ridiculous nickname like Adam Clearoff Clayton and stuff like that.
Or
Rick Astley and Ruddy Big Pig and all of these things.
Big Pig came down on the street.
It's pop, but it is supposed to be fun, and I think people do forget that sometimes. It's entertainment, it's showbiz, it's supposed to be fun, and I think when we start to forget that and take it all a bit too seriously, then we just miss the point.
Absolutely right. Well, Smash Hits was Jumbo Rilliant, and Brian McCluskey's Like Punk Never Happened archive is available on the internet now, dead easy to find. Okay, that's our show. Thank you to our guests, Zoe Howe, whose Stevie Nicks, Visions, Dreams and Rumours, and also her novel Shine on Marky Moon, are available now at all good bookshops. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you to Eamon Ford, who is all up in all your social medias right now and completely unavoidable across the internet. Thank you, Eamon.
Thank you very much.
Remember, you can hear this show again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. Or why not subscribe at iTunes? Just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth, subscribe, and you will get the podcast version a day early. How about that then, eh? Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday. Stand firm, Britain. We will see you next week.